on the next exciting episode of Star Trek The Next Generation.
It seems clear that my life is to end in the late 19th century.
Data faces a shocking fate.
We've lost him.
And embarks on a mission of no return.
I'm not willing to accept that he's dead and just leave it at that.
Now, to bring him back alive.
My God.
The crew must cross a chilling gateway into terror.
Data!
Next time on Star Trek The Next Generation.
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, reporting for duty.
And we have a very special guest strolling in his Colonel Sanders outfit, Tony Galoosh.
Hi, everyone. Nice to see you again.
Well, Tony, we always love having you back on the show. We get a lot of outreach from listeners asking for you to return. So why can we not give the listeners what they want by having you back?
Hey, good to see you. Hey.
And speaking of what the listeners want, here's our review of Time's Arrow.
Well, Cam, let's talk a little bit about like our first impressions of it when we saw it the first time, of course. Tony, you mentioned right before we kicked this off that it's been a long, long time since you last saw Time's Arrow. Tell me, what was your first impressions way back in the 90s?
Well, I don't... it had been a while. I can't really recall what my reaction to it was, to be honest. It had been that long, but... I don't remember feeling about it the way I feel about it now.
Okay. Well, Cam, it's only been a year for you. Fair enough?
Yeah, that's about right.
Has your opinion changed at all?
No, not really. So I'll just leave that to the next part.
I remember watching this as a kid and loving the bejesus out of this. To me, this is Star Trek at its peak. It was just such a great concept for them to, you know, put the fish out of the water. And just explore Data, especially as the Frenchman in San Francisco. I loved it as a kid. I thought Samuel Clemens was like just this fantastic character. Couldn't get enough of. My, how times have changed. I'm curious, Tony. It's now 2016. Tell me what your impressions are nowadays.
Well, I actually like the time travel episodes generally on Star Trek. But... I have to say that as good a job as Jerry Hardin put into it, his portrayal of Mark Twain is possibly the least charismatic Mark Twain in all of cinema.
Did you know that his performance in this episode spawned a one-man show?
I didn't know that. I'm not surprised it was a one-man show.
And a one-audience show, too.
Well, Cam, let's hear a little bit about your thoughts, because obviously your thoughts haven't changed that much, but I'm curious, what do you think is the best part of Time's Arrow?
I actually kind of enjoyed this two-parter.
Yeah?
I gotta be honest. I mean, look, I guess when we're talking two-parters in TNG, the gold standard is Best of Both Worlds. Obviously, they weren't trying to compete with that anymore. Like, I think they gave up after Redemption.
Sure.
In terms of, series season finales and season premieres. Redemption was what it was. You can listen to our review on that one if you want to hear what we thought of it. But, then they followed that up with Unification. Again, we just recently reviewed that one. It's pretty clunky. It has good moments, but it's not great. This one, as a science fiction episode, I don't think it's very good. I don't think it has a concept that's particularly interesting. But I think it's very consistent throughout. It is a solid hour and a half, kind of lighthearted, back-in-time, next-generation adventure.
You know, I wrote in my notes as well, most consistent two-parter since Encounter at Farpoint.
Yeah.
Even more so than Best of Both Worlds, because as much as we love that episode, you watch the second part, not nearly as compelling as part one.
Yeah, this is pure compelling.
Of course.
Well, I'm assuming that by consistent, you mean consistent in tone and not particularly internally consistent?
Well, what Cam and I have found, like, going through all these Next Gen 2 parters, is that part one usually is pretty solid episode, and then you come back to part two, and they're just, like, throwing plates up in the air, spin in place as well. They have so many story threads that they're trying to juggle. These two-part episodes, the second part are usually a bit of a mess.
It usually doesn't even kind of feel like it connects very well to the first part.
Yeah.
But did this one really need to be a two-parter?
Well, that is the question, and I think we'll go into that. But it's interesting because it originally wasn't going to be a two-parter. It was just going to be a season finale. And they were just going to leave it at that. But then there was so much hype for DS9 that they didn't want audiences to think, like, TNG was over. So they thought audiences might just think this was the series finale.
It ended with Data losing his head.
So ultimately they decided to stretch it as a two-parter to open the next season to basically be like, you know, we're back, yo.
I bet there was a lot of fans hoping that Samuel Clemens would be joining the main cast aboard the Enterprise.
And this, you know, period era, 19th century San Francisco, like, Ronald D. Moore said he really wished they could have used this, like, for more of a season. Like, he felt they didn't use it enough.
Sure. Yeah. I don't know. Well, you know, okay, my... Just quickly, you know, like, my thoughts, and then we can talk about what works specifically. But, Cam, I agree with you. I think this is one fun swashbuckling adventure for the Next Gen crew.
I don't know if there's any swashbuckling.
I don't know. That Mr. Pickard was he looked pretty badass in that vest that he had on. It was a very piratey vest.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great vest action, but we'll talk about that a little bit later on in this episode. But I agree, like, this is a fun Next Generation episode. I could not believe... Here's the thing. A lot of my thoughts about these episodes going in are tempered by what my original experience was, you know, watching it in the 90s. I really thought that I maybe overhyped this episode in my own head, so I went in with low expectations. Look, 9-year-old Tyler loved this episode. He really did. I had a blast watching it. You know, this is a great two-parter. So I'm just curious. I mean, what worked for you guys? What, and Tony, there may not be much that worked for you, but tell me what did work for you.
Well, I agree with you. I actually thought that the aliens were really cool. when they, you know, they do the
ones that look like Clint Howard with mutton chops.
I thought they were pretty neat. I thought that... I couldn't really understand why they had a snake, but
yeah, I didn't really.
That was a little strange. Yeah.
But yeah, I thought they looked pretty neat. I thought that kind of subplot was cool and dark. You know, these aliens that feed on human misery at the end of life, and it was balanced out with the crazy cat and mouse game of Mark Twain and Data and Guinan.
Doing, like, the most badass leap through a temporal vortex you could ever imagine.
He's like going with them!
He literally looked like he was trying to do the Superman flyby as he jumped into that vortex. It was like, whoa.
Obviously a stuntman.
I don't think so.
Yeah, speaking of those aliens, they reminded me a lot of, like, the Schism aliens. Those freaky, like, ones that kidnapped Riker. Like, it was a similar sort of nightmarish design going on with the ones that were eating things in with their forehead.
Well, it's curious because, obviously, for budgetary issues, most of these aliens are just pretty much people wearing, like, makeup.
Yeah.
You know? And when they go that extra mile and actually put a lot more thought into the alien design process, yeah. I dig it, you know, on Next Gen. I know the writers weren't as happy with the Schism aliens.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this is maybe their effort to get those Schism aliens right?
I mean, I guess. And I think one of the key things they did that actually made them a little unsettling was keep them kind of out of phase.
Yeah.
So you don't get a really good look at them.
I wonder if we did, if they just would have looked like garbage.
I think they probably would have. Because yeah. God knows that set did. This episode is basically going to be summed up as like the cruise adventures from Tom Sawyer Island in Disneyland to the backlot of Universal Studios.
Pretty much.
Well, actually, that was one thing. I mean, you guys know better than I, but can you confirm, do they always go to the same cave?
Yes.
Pretty much, yeah. And DS9 gets a lot of mileage out of that cave, too.
They do, like, have, like, different pieces from the cave that they'll move around to try to make the cave look different, but there's only so many different ways you can make this cave look different. It doesn't really fool the average viewer, in my opinion, anyway.
it's a bit clunky as a cave.
But you know what? They had a syndicated budget.
Yeah.
You know, the show, you should be happy they made it on the air and they were able to keep all the starships afloat. That's all I can say.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, when we get to our best and worst caves episode, you know, we'll give maybe this one modest grades. So, getting back to what works, like, I think this episode has a lot of good comedy. A lot of bad comedy, too, but a lot of good comedy.
We were laughing a lot, and it was intentional humor, a lot of the data stuff, and unintentional humor.
Yes.
But even just, like, little things like Data getting mistaken for, you know, being in his pajamas, and he was saying, oh, I understand your misperception of me. He's referring to his uniform, you know? Like, just simple stuff like that. Cam, what stuck out to you as a funny moment?
One of my favorite was after, you know, Data has won big at the poker tournament. It's a great reveal because it just goes from him dealing cards, cutting to him walking to a room in, like, a feathered hat and a, like, pimp vest.
He looked very pimpin', literally, at that. I think that would be my next Star Trek Las Vegas convention costume.
That would be amazing.
Maybe I'll do it.
That would be so awesome.
It'd be pretty Data. Easy. Just
just a pimp outfit plus the Data uniform underneath.
Plus, yeah.
And a bowler hat with a feather in it.
Are you going to do all the makeup, though?
Yeah, I'll do it. Okay.
That would be pretty great.
You know what? That struck out to me. Oh, guys, we were also laughing. And I don't know how intentional this is, but the police chase scene with them blowing on their whistles.
like the Keystone Cops.
Here's the thing. It was an amazing reveal because Riker announces that he has the utmost respect for the law. Then he clocks this police officer right in the noggin. They run out and Data's there with a horse and buggy. Just waiting to make the getaway.
Yeah.
And they're being chased by cops with whistles, blowing whistles at them as if they're going to come back. I don't know.
Data stuntman drives away.
Yeah. Waving their truncheons in the air.
This is a funny episode. Here's the thing. I think sometimes humor in Star Trek is kind of clunky, but other times so much of it is just character-based. The actors know what to do to get a laugh out of this. I think, you know, Brent Spiner was on fire throughout this entire episode.
He's been on fire for a couple of these two-parters we've done, because he was really good in Unification, too. And I like that while the focus on the characters kind of shifts a bit when you get to the second part, it's not like Data suddenly disappears in the second part.
No.
Which has happened in a lot of the other two-parters we've seen.
But you know what I actually noticed, though? And here's what was very clear to me, though, is the writers had clearly mapped out both parts one and two simultaneously, and they also gave all the characters something to do.
Well, both parts were written by Joe Manosky. So it was actually the same writer writing both parts. It was different co-writers. Part one was co-written by Michael Piller, and part two was Jerry Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
But just having the one person kind of have the overall vision, I think, helps a lot.
Well, but we got that with Ron Moore doing Redemption Parts 1 and 2, but it's very clear to me that they did not know how they're going to resolve the whole Klingon Civil War stuff in that two-parter. This one, here's the thing, they had to have known what this, you know, this head meant. Mm-hmm. They were even calling, like, the bellboy Jack. They had set up that he was going to be Jack London. To me, it was so very clear, you know, that they wanted to have all the characters included in San Francisco doing something, so they had Crusher there doing the medical sort of stuff.
Except Worf.
Well, or as Samuel Clemens called him, a werewolf. I would like to call him Were-Worf, but the one thing I'm disappointed by is after the entire senior staff leave for 19th century San Fran, I would have loved to see what Worf was doing as captain of, like, the Enterprise all on his own. Like, everybody would have been, like, shaking in their boots, I think. Like, he's a tough cookie, I think.
That would have been a fun comedy beat.
I thought that was a kind of a poor operational decision, was to send all of the senior staff on the Enterprise.
That's a mistake they make a lot on that series. Yeah,
without really checking into where the portal went or what it did or if it just evaporated people, they just were all pretty calm about walking through it.
But what do you think about that kind of the shout out to, say, City on the Edge of Tomorrow? Like, you've got, like, this, you're in San Francisco, you've got, like, this Chinese actor walk by, and then all of a sudden Data's going around saying, I'm French. It's a shout out to, of course, Spock claiming he's Chinese when he's walking around New York City in the 30s.
Well, another City on the Edge of Forever nod is also that he's sitting in his room building basically a machine, just like Spock does in that Depression era period.
Yeah, like, it's obviously kind of written by the writers in as very much an homage to an episode that they appreciated. This is definitely fun. City on the Edge of Forever, would you call that a fun episode?
I would. I would say okay. It's half really fun and half tragic.
Okay. I would call it very... if we had to, like, delineate different genres, I'd call City on the Edge of Forever more of a drama sort of genre. And this would... I would call this more of a comedy.
I would agree with that. So. I think this has some serious tones to it. I think maybe when we get into what doesn't work, I'll touch on that, sure. on that a little more. But I kind of like that it has like a goofy conspiracy that they're trying to figure out.
Yeah.
And it's never lost. Like that thread is never lost. When we got to like unification last time and part two is going all crazy with Sela stuff. It's like, how did this relate to part one?
Well,
you know, not very well.
And, well, the thing is like we were genuinely confused with like the narrative that they're telling in part two. I wasn't confused at all during like this episode. Like it's very clear to me what was going on throughout the entire time.
Do you think you would look at this one as favorably if you hadn't just watched Unification and Redemption?
Well, okay. That's a tricky question because I'm going to jump forward just a little bit. We've touched upon this, but I think Samuel Clemens does not work at all.
what are you talking about?
Yes. He just doesn't... He sticks out like a sore thumb among all the characters. Here's the thing. We've talked about it before, Cam. Like, most of acting is reacting. And just trying to see him react to the responses he's getting and the other actors just trying to do their regular thing and, like... Who is this dude just dropping in there and talking like this, son of a boy?
And his voice always goes low and then high!
Yeah, it was pretty aggravating. But, I mean, we're not on the stuff that didn't work yet, are we?
No.
Cam's question was, would I have looked on this as favorably if had I not just come off, you know, the two-weeker two-parters?
Mm-hmm.
I would say that I would still be stuck watching Samuel Clemens, and maybe I would not have been as impressed with this just because of that one character versus, you know, having seen how much they struggle with the two-parters throughout Next Generation, because they really do struggle with, you know, that part two out of all these two-parters.
Yeah.
This is a really solid two-part episode all the way through.
I think when the first time I watched it, I maybe liked it a little bit less. Not a lot, but just because... I think as I was going through season 5, there was a lot of really good episodes. So this was kind of at the tail end of the season, as opposed to bouncing off of something really crappy.
Literally, the episode that preceded this was The Inner Light.
Yeah.
And you're coming off, like, there's strong episodes like Darmok that's, like, later on in season 2.
Like, these are, like, all-timer episodes.
Yeah.
So I think this felt like a minor step down. Well, okay, from The Inner Light's a major step down. But it was...
You just wish Samuel Clemens was somehow inserted into The Inner Light?
Yeah. I just, honestly, I really enjoy the consistency of it.
Yeah.
And even, okay, like, and I think maybe having Les Landau direct both parts helped a lot, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because we saw with Unification, for example, different directors each part. Part one, characters are acting like they're deaf and, like, acting as if they're, like, on a stage. And then part two is much more natural. So this one felt consistent in that regard. But, like, did
you... I think you wanted to see the return of that admiral from part one of Unification.
The contest winner?
Yes.
Yeah. No, did either of you notice, like, that Riker was angry throughout both two parts?
Yeah, you know what? He was a guy who was kind of, pissed off about the whole concept of Data's mortality. Like, he just cannot come to grips with it at all.
Yeah.
And he's fighting it the whole time, and then he reluctantly agrees, we need to blow the shit out of this planet.
Yeah.
Which I do enjoy, you know, Troy's teaching Samuel Clemens about how we live in a universe where we all get along with each other, and the entire time they're ready to fire photon torpedoes at this planet.
At the recommendation of Werewolf.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, for sure. But I thought it was interesting that they then cut to the second part. You know, we got him, like, spazzing out over the mortality aspect. And who knew Star Trek liked to talk about mortality?
Oh, I'm shocked.
But then you get to the second part, and he's, like, angry at everyone over the missiles being shot at the caverns over the whole Picard issue. He's just always angry. And then he's, like, punching out cops. This is, like, the Riker angry two-parter.
You know what? Maybe that's why he's dressed up as a cop. He likes to, you know, engage in a little bit of police brutality of his own.
Mm, topical.
I did think that if you're going for a low-profile... Prime Directive type of costume, probably dressing up like a officer of the law is not your first choice.
Well, they were like the 19th century village people in this episode.
I Oh, I loved it. They were Picard's, like, Shakespeare troupe. Yeah. Like, I thought that was hilarious to me.
I get a little tired of the Shakespeare stuff, I gotta be honest, when he's like, well, we're performing Midsummer's Night Dream. It's like,
Okay, what did you think about, like, the blind joke on Geordi where, like, he's holding his play upside down and they have to, like, correct him?
Yeah, that was pretty great.
I was just like, okay, they're going for it, you know? And then, like, every time that Miss Carmichael would come up to the room to check on them, and they'd all have to shuffle about and get the right attire on. Geordi would have to take his visor off.
It was very like light comedy, which traditionally Star Trek really flounders when it is. But here it actually worked.
Do you think what was it more to you, just the writing or the acting about how? Because I think a lot of it's like the actors know how they can pull this off without it looking stupid.
Oh, I think the actors can easily do this stuff. I think a lot of the time it's the director, who creates too heavy a vibe, and like so he grounds it in this sort of serious realism. And then it's like actors trying to play light comedy in a really like moody sort of atmosphere. And that does not work. And we've seen that happen time and time again, and especially TNG.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you brought up, you know, Les Landau directing both parts. I think he was essentially a number two director behind David Carson throughout the series.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think this is a good showcase for him. I think at this time, David Carson may have even been preparing for the Deep Space Nine series premiere at this point. So.
Well, didn't Les Landau direct the first part of Unification?
Oh, wasn't the part that we thought was really horribly directed?
I thought it was... Well, yes, but that had also the best comedy in it. It had all the stuff with Data and Picard bunking together and stuff like that. So, like, I think maybe that might be his specialty, is getting really good character comedy.
So maybe it makes sense that they knew, hey, we've got Les Landau directing this, let's ramp up the comedy. We know he can do it. Because I think they would have the director figured out, like, on the schedule before they had ever start, you know, writing this particular episode.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, for sure. So, what else worked for you, Tony?
Well, I don't know if it's something that worked or didn't work, but I did notice that the members of the crew were all doing different things. They didn't really seem to be doing their task-specific items.
Right.
I didn't really mind it that much, but, you know, I was kind of wondering how did Geordi ever become an expert on cellular fossils? how did Crusher, how did she ever become an expert on, you know, time portals?
She's related to Wesley, who, of course, is off with the Traveler, you know.
Oh, I guess that's that's true. She comes by it, honestly. She gets postcards.
There was, you know, that episode where she hung out with the Traveler quite a bit and remembered me.
So, right, yeah.
There you go.
The Traveler gives many gifts to the series.
Especially the Crushers. I did like Crusher in this episode because she's usually forgotten about in these two-parters. A lot of these characters are, but Crusher's there. She even had that great remark to the Doctor. Mm-hmm. She was just like, yeah, I think I can handle it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, but it's kind of good stuff, like... that even, like, Troy was given lots of stuff to do. I love the turbolift talk that she and Riker had with Data about mortality. She was escorting Samuel Clemens around the ship, you know.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. These two-parters typically aren't ensembles. Mm-hmm. They're just, like, showcases for one or two characters, and everybody else, like, Cam, you and I think, brought up that in Redemption, like, none of the other characters other than, like, I believe Picard and Worf really had more than one or two lines in part one.
Yeah.
So this, you know, seeing that they were actively giving something to all of the characters to do, I think they were actually learning a lot of the lessons that they had to go through from the previous two-parters that they must have realized just weren't as consistent or weren't as successful as maybe they wanted them.
Well, what is it about Star Trek time travel episodes really bringing out the best in, like, ensemble writing? Because, you know, Tony, you were here for, famously, our Voyage Home episode.
Yeah.
Which was one of my favorite episodes we've ever done. But, you know, that episode, while we weren't that big on it, we didn't think it held up that well, it did give every character major, like, funny moments. Like, it really balanced the ensemble fairly well.
Except Sulu.
Except, well, he did have the helicopter scene.
Yeah, that's true.
But, like, what is it with, like, time travel always paying off really well when it comes to an ensemble in Star Trek?
I think it's just because they get to put on funny hats and and pretend to be, you know, their characters get to pretend to be characters in another era.
Yeah, Spock did have that badass bandana that he was wearing in Voyager.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of it is just kind of that fish out of water, you know, scenario that the writers are just like, hey, I wonder how this character would react in this situation, or how that character would react in this situation. So I think if the writers have some fun stuff to do with them, they'll totally jump on it.
Yeah, no, I agree. There was one moment I wanted to talk about, actually, that I thought really worked well. And it's not one that's going to jump out as, like, you know, no one's going to hold this up as their favorite moment of Time Zero.
Was it Picard holding the Colt 45 at the very beginning?
Oh, you guessed it.
Not great gun safe.
No. He had it, like, pointed at his eyeball. He's like, ooh.
What's in here?
It's an antique.
The thing about it is that gun was almost certainly loaded. Because Samuel Clemens was holding them hostage with it when it was dropped.
But no, the moment is actually the scene where Data has phased out of sort of visibility for the rest of the crew.
Yeah.
He's describing what he's seeing.
You know, I actually thought that was really well directed.
Yes. Like that scene where he's just describing it, you know, there's many times over the course of Star Trek where people are just talking in exposition and you are not getting anything out of it. Like, it's just brutal.
Do you know what worked for me, and Cam, maybe you're about to say this, and I'm a really rude person for interrupting you, but just how they would cut back up to the bridge and then just have the camera moving as Picard observed what was going on, just hearing this disembodied voice of Data describing it.
No, exactly. It's the camera's panning across the faces of all the crew members as they're sort of hearing what he's saying, and what he's describing is so strange that you're like, you start trying to, you know, come up with your own mental picture as to what it is. And that's rare. TNG, I found, is not great at suggesting things that aren't being shown.
Yeah, and I think we've also tackled this just the other week with our Brian Fuller podcast, talking about how Star Trek's visuals aren't always the most captivating.
I was going to say, it's also not always the best at showing things that are being suggested. The game.
I think the dolphin, you know, that's a pretty amazing...
That is a pretty amazing one. Now, I'm curious for both of you, speaking of the romance of the Dauphin, what did you guys think about the Picard Guinan stuff in this episode?
Well, okay, guys, I kept writing in my notes, I've never understood the relationship. Like, is it, like, a sexual thing that they don't, like, really explicitly come out and say on the ship? Because that's what it seems like a... Not necessarily just sexual, but very sensual.
I was hoping one of you guys would know, because it's always been a puzzle to me as to what exactly their relationship is.
He knew Guinan before she was on the Enterprise in 10-4. And I'm not talking about because of this time travel. Like, they had clearly gotten to know each other before either of them were on the Enterprise. So... I don't know. Like, here's the thing. Like, he's, like, Picard's literally telling, you know, Madame Guinan, you know, we go far beyond friendship.
Yeah.
You tell that to another woman, I can only imagine what that means. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's what, I don't know, what do you guys interpret as their relationship? Like, what is it?
I always got the vibe that there was something romantic involved, but it's like the show never kind of paid it off or gave you anything really at all. It's kind of like a lot of fans talk about the Picard Crusher relationship, and again, that is not really paid off. You do get an episode like Attached, which does give you a lot, but it's, you never really get to see their romance. Just like with the Guinan one, you never really get to see what it's all about.
Do you think it's better that they left it ambiguous?
I don't know. The thing about the Picard is that you never get a sense of what his, like, personal life really is beyond the odd episode, like, Lessons.
Yeah.
I always thought it was more of a mother-son relationship, but in the context of what's going on here, that seems kind of weird.
Like a Bates Motel type thing?
Maybe.
I don't know. Does your relationship with your mother go far beyond friendship? That's a long,
Mom, Mom's great.
Pause.
Mom, if you're listening, you're great. Mom, I love you.
There you go. Here's the thing. Like, I don't necessarily need this to be answered. I'm just always curious and kind of left scratching my head. And here's the thing. Like, Guinan said in the past, you know, she's very attracted to bald men.
Yeah.
Like, so there's, like, an attraction there between the two of them. Like,
she's kind of a guide over his destiny, too. Because you get to, like, Generations where she's showing up on the merry-go-round. like, she's kind of overseeing Picard's life.
Yeah.
In a weird way.
And even, like, the whole, you know, like yesterday's Enterprise,
yeah.
where she's just saying to him, look, do you trust me more than anything else? And he says, yes. She's like, you need to trust me on this, with the whole Tasha Yar does not belong here conversation. So there's really something between the two. I don't know, maybe it would, the audiences would be disappointed if they kind of just spelled out exactly what it was.
Maybe.
You know, I'm kind of fine with it being ambiguous.
Now, I'm trying to remember, and this goes back a long way, a fair amount of time for me. Did they ever establish, when she first kind of joined the show, the sort of the deepness of their relationship? Did it just kind of come out of nowhere, or was it built?
Okay, so 10 Forward was introduced beginning of season 2.
Yes.
And I do remember, like, it's Picard that goes and meets up with Guinan first. Like, mm-hmm. that's how we're introduced to her character.
Mm-hmm.
Do they explicitly acknowledge this deep, deep relationship? It doesn't jump out to me. I yeah. could be mistaken, but I think yeah. it's something that's more alluded to as the series goes on.
Mm-hmm.
But to me,
she's more kind of a spiritual advisor.
Yeah.
Kind of like Chakotay's spirit guides in Star Trek Voyager.
Right, or Vedic Barral for Kira.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously. Guys, let me ask you this. What exactly does Madame Guinan do on Earth? Like, I didn't understand who she was or like, what
I thought she traveled from town to town selling dresses with pneumatic sleeves.
In the least racist version of the 19th century America you could ever imagine.
I was going to say, because in the second part of this, Samuel Clemens talks about the prejudice of his, you know, 19th century America. We do not see any evidence of that in the actual two-parter, because you've got Guinan kind of being a socialite, throwing all these parties for yeah. the kind of the rich, you know, Caucasian people. But then you've also got Geordi walking around with no one commenting.
There's a couple black people in the background of yeah. the series, and it's just like they're all just mixing and mingling. I realize San Francisco, you're very liberal, but even back in the 19th century, I think race may have still been an issue in the United States.
Possibly.
Well, possibly, yeah.
I mean, I've read Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn. Samuel Clemens liked to throw around a certain word a lot.
Which one was that?
Friend. No, a certain N-word, if you will. And, you know, he used
which
this...
one?
The bad one. The word that...
Sing it in a rap song, Cam.
No, there you go. Yeah, you know exactly what it is. But he would use that throughout Huck Finn, constantly, to refer to the character of Jim. So, the fact that, you know...
Nice.
Neighbor. The fact that he would, you know, you would have Samuel Clemens... you know, hanging out with Guinan, you know, around Geordi, but play it as kind of this sort of Disneyland version of 19th century America.
Yeah.
Is, I mean, I get it. They're
it's
kind of
very problematic.
It's problematic. I get it that they're making like a farce episode, but at the same time, the character is acknowledging all the prejudice.
Yeah.
Which I think if they left that out, it would have been a little easier to coast by on.
I think they could have touched upon it without it being a super, super heavy episode. I'm not saying you need to drop N-bombs or anything like that.
No.
I don't know if that would have worked for a family TV show. But I don't know. It rubs me the wrong way that we don't have any sort of acknowledgments about this big, big issue, especially when you have these main characters. Now, the argument is that, okay, well, 24th century, why would anybody comment on race? Guys, we're in the 19th century here. That's why it really bothers me.
Yeah. No, I agree 100%. And I think that, you know, in maybe a little more of an ambitious two-parter, they could have made that maybe the central theme of the episode about the differences between the 19th century and the 24th century.
Yeah.
But I just don't think they were interested in going there at all.
Well, guys, is there anything else you wanted to mention about what works before we maybe talk a little bit more about what doesn't work?
I want to just make a note, because this isn't something we normally bring up, but costuming. I thought the costume work in this was actually really good. It actually won an Emmy for costumes and also hairstyling.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Was that Mark Alemo's mutton chops that he had at the poker table?
That's solely what was there. They put up for a submission, yes.
I loved Data's facial expressions when he was speaking French. He was like, what's the most stereotypical offensive, like, French facial expressions I can do? There you go.
But yeah, I mean, we've seen a lot of period era Star Trek stuff where the costumes don't necessarily look the most convincing. I thought these worked within sort of their Disneyland 19th century San Francisco.
I agree, yeah.
And I thought it was very colorful, vibrant. It looked like movie quality costumes, not like, some of the costumes we would see in like the first three seasons of TNG.
Thrift store costumes.
Yes, exactly. Like, I'm thinking proto-Vulcans at the moment.
All right. Well, guys, let's talk a little bit about, I think, kind of the elephant in the room. Samuel Clemens. I don't know. This guy, when he first appeared when I was a kid, I was like, oh, yeah, that's Albert Einstein. Or, you know, it took me a little while to figure it out that, nope.
KFC.
skinny boss hog.
But no, like, because there was that reporter that referred to him as Mark Twain. So as a kid, I did figure out who it was. But yeah. I thought he was like this, like, fun-loving dude, you know, like, to me, it seemed intriguing. Watching this as an adult, I'm like, oh my god, this dude's insufferable. This actor's not working out. Why did Les Landau just allow him to keep going on as he did? Like, did he just blow the socks off everyone during the audition process? I don't know. Sorry, Jerry Hardin, but like, this just really took me out of the episode whenever he was on screen.
Tony?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what it was. I mean, the way he spoke was just so aggravating.
What are you talking about?
Which it kind of would have been fine as a bit character or something like that, but as a episode driver,
yeah,
you know, it wasn't the best. It wasn't really clear why he was so driven, and you know, he's supposed to be a writer, but they never really go. They mention his writing a little bit, but for the most part, he seems like he's a geologist detective.
They mentioned one book. Which was the A Yankee in King Arthur's Court.
A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. But which was also a time travel book, which it made sense for here. I was kind of thinking that maybe that this would serve as inspiration for A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, but instead the reporter just asked him a sequel to that particular time travel novel.
Right. Did they use the word sequel then? That jumped out at me. I was like, is that a word that existed back then?
It'd be amazing if the guy asked about a threequel or a prequel.
Yeah. A reboot.
Yeah. I just started randomly talking about J.J. Abrams. Yeah. Well, speaking of weird voices, what was up with Madame Guinan's voice? What kind of voice was that supposed to be? It vacillated from like Southern to like upper crust English, and the whole time it just sounded like Whoopi Goldberg's bad acting.
That didn't bother me too much. I just figured she was kind of putting on an act, you know, because she wasn't from there originally.
But what kind of voice is that?
Well,
I didn't notice, to be honest.
Yeah, I didn't really notice much, honestly.
Really? It was not Guinan's usual voice, though.
It was kind of an old-timey voice.
She's I'm Guinan, Madam Guinan.
Did people in San Francisco talk like that?
Well, the thing is, like, San Francisco had only been around for, like, 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
So, like, nobody was actually from San Francisco
right,
at the
I
time.
Guess. Yeah,
I think
sense.
It was the bombastic oscillation of Mark Twain that probably just distracted me from anything else.
There's
sonic
a scene
in that voice
with Mark Twain where it, you know, Guinan has her like literary party or whatever, where he's just walking around in a circle, blithering, and I'm like,
smoking cigars.
How would anyone want to like be around this guy? And the thing is, they play it up as he's someone that people really like being having around, like he's this like curious old curmudgeon. And I'm like, this guy's a jerk.
But I did kind of like that initial conversation when they're just talking about man's place in the universe. I was like, oh, this is kind of interesting. I was with Mark Twain, and then he kept talking and talking and talking. And I just, here's the thing. Take away that dumb voice that the actor was speaking with. Do you think that Mark Twain or Samuel Clemens could have been like a character that you would not use the word insufferable to describe?
Well, I think he could have been, even without the voice, a little bit more intriguing. The voice doesn't help. You know, just a note, whenever anyone so far on your show here has tried to imitate Mark Twain, I've noticed on your computer it's set the levels out of control, so you guys are going to have some difficult editing to do.
We'll figure it out.
but just the actor, I don't know if you noticed, it was like every time he talked, his hands were shaking at his side. I don't know if he was meant to do that. He kind of had the look of an actor who had won an audition, mm-hmm. and then was, you know, had given his lines and was, you know, a dependable TV character actor that could walk in, stand on an X, turn towards the right camera, and give a line without really blowing the budget.
Well, did this feel like a caricature to you as opposed to an actual character?
But the problem is like, caricature of what exactly? It's because it's not like we have like audio recordings of like Twain's voice from back in the day.
Could there be? They used to record them like on records.
Yeah, but that would have like been the old 20 years, 30 years later.
Yeah.
We're way too, ahead of time to be doing that.
I like the reference to Halley's Comet. That was a nice touch.
You ever get hit by Halley's Comet?
I will say this about the Mark Twain character. I did like the scene of him talking to Deanna Troi, where they're just kind of talking about his time versus hers. Like, I thought that was... He actually dialed it down a bit in that scene. Like, he's kind of, like, just more contemplative. He wasn't kind of doing this grandstanding act that he does in every other scene of the episode.
Sure. I remember him unleashing a very weird sound when the bullion walked by him out of the turbo lift. He was just like...
He was like Yoda.
Yeah.
Strange you are. Yeah, like... I would love to just, like, almost, like, just watch, like, I actually had more fun with Mark Twain just kind of walking around the Enterprise than I did at all the stuff of him in the 19th century.
I agree. Yeah.
I really didn't enjoy that much of the stuff of him running around, getting, like, mixed up in their caper. But when it was just him walking around the Enterprise reacting to things, I found that more entertaining because, like, maybe it's just the fish out of water comedy from him. And I think he was better at reacting to things than just, like, hey, Jerry, can you just dominate this scene?
Well, let me ask you this. If Chaucer was brought, onto a naval battleship in the present day, would he be hanging out on the bridge of that particular battleship as Clemens was in this episode?
They're very generous on TNG.
They really are.
Just letting celebrities onto the bridge.
Yeah, everyone. They let Wesley Crusher sit on the bridge. Why not, Samuel Clemens?
It's kind of like if you're a celebrity in the old days, you could, like, go into the cockpit and say hi to the pilot.
I remember I actually did that as a kid, like, growing up. Like,
oh, really?
I'd go sit in the cockpit and, like, watch them fly the plane.
Is it a crop duster?
Yeah, I used to do that, but then they caught me with some full-size shampoo and some nail clippers, and since then I'm on the no-fly list.
Well, it's, before we kind of leave the Mark Twain bit of this episode, we should talk about the fact that this performance was so popular that it ultimately inspired Jerry Hardin to do a one-man show of Mark Twain. And first off, before we get, I get into a little bit of a review I've got, I'm just curious, would either of you pay, I'm going to guess it's not expensive, but say pay $20 to see Jerry Hardin portray Mark Twain for 2 hours?
Now, Jerry Hardin in the 90s or Jerry Hardin now?
1997, let's say.
Okay. Would I pay $20 in 1997 to watch him do this? You know what? Young Tyler really dug Samuel Clemens back in the 90s. Contemporary Tyler would run away, run far, far away from this one-man show.
I'm not generally a fan of one-man shows anyways.
Mm-hmm. And, so you're not going to come to mine?
Vagina monologues?
Well, it depends. What show are you doing, Cameron?
The one-man version of Cats.
Oh, that sounds great. I love to see you in a onesie doing flips.
Playing the magical Mr. Mistopheles. So, I found a review of Jerry Hardin's performance. This was printed in
Is
the...
Is it yours?
I wish. This was printed in the Irish Times on Friday, July 18th, 1997.
Can you read it in an Irish voice?
No.
Pretend you're Mrs. Carmichael.
By Mike
or
Casey.
Or Colm Meaney.
With the grace and poise of Twain's remarkable gift for a good story well told, Hardin weaves a delicate web of satire, charm, and intrigue. He gives us tales of innocent guns and harmless cheese, and reads from the diaries of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, all the while postulating the theory of anti-Darwinism and the descent of man. Throughout, it is the skill of these two masters, writer and actor, that keep us hanging on every perfectly judged word. As Twain himself once quipped, the reports of his death are very much exaggerated.
Well, that's amazing, because of course, Captain Picard makes that reference in Star Trek First Contact.
Yes.
Obviously, Sam Clemens taught him a whole lot.
Yeah. So, when you hear a review that glowing, would you expect this off of what we just saw?
Absolutely not.
Well, maybe he's better when he's reading Mark Twain instead of reading
a Star Trek script's
take on Mark Twain.
But could you imagine this actor directing himself? If this is what Les Landau made him tone down to,
yeah,
I can only imagine what he was like up on stage where he's just directing himself.
Maybe it would have taken it to the next level. Maybe that's what wow. maybe that's what it was missing.
So speaking of things that don't work, one thing that really bugs me about this episode, and it shouldn't because I know it's just done for cheap gags, but why does the crew not take money when they go to these sort of time periods? Yeah. Like, they always act clueless. Like, what? We need money for rent?
Well, I was going to say, actually, I mean, it's not just money, but I always wonder, sure, it's been 400 years or 300 years. Mm-hmm. How long? 400?
500.
500?
Yeah.
But, you know, just referring to, like, okay, you know, you might not see glasses too often, mm-hmm. but, you know, I'd still be like, yeah, those are glasses. Not those are bifocal visual aids.
Right.
I'd still know what a broadsword is.
Yeah, the whole money issue, here's the thing. They don't have money in the 24th century.
But wouldn't you know this?
They wouldn't even be able to replicate it. It's not even programmed into the replicators.
It's not in the data banks what money looked like from the 19th century America.
Wouldn't data understand the difference between, $10 and a huge wad of bills?
Yeah, really? Keep the change.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, here's the thing. You say that, you know, they don't realize money's an issue. I'm very confused about how Riker ends up being like a constable all of a sudden.
Who uses open hand punches?
Yeah. But like, how does he end up with a uniform that's identical to the other cop's uniform?
Well, how did any of those get... How did Crusher end up working as a nurse?
Yeah.
Did they establish... Did she submit a resume?
How long were they searching for data, like, before they actually got to this point? It seemed as if they're in San Francisco for weeks.
Wouldn't you want to dress up in very casual civilian garb as opposed to a police officer so someone's not running up to you like, police, I need your help?
Yeah, well, he was waving that billy club pretty hard like in the background as well. Yeah, they're really not doing all that well going incognito. Here's the thing, maybe Riker did not even realize that was a policeman's outfit. He just he's like, he's just picking things off the clothesline and he's like, okay, I guess this is what I got. It's the only thing that'll fit this like 6'5" frame.
I just think that's really strange, especially like, I would imagine at this point in time, the adventures of Kirk going back to save, you know, the whales would be within historical record and be something that they would recognize. Like, wouldn't they have learned from that example?
Okay, I'm putting you on the spot.
Yes.
You're going back to 17th century Italy. How much money are you bringing with you? And what currency? Now.
10 lire.
Okay, that would buy you nothing.
I honestly don't know, but I also don't have a data bank telling me, like, the history of civilization. Yeah.
Computer, kindly replicate a bunch of money from this era.
Okay, if you're going to send me on a time travel back there, I'm probably going to Google it.
No, sorry. An XE.com isn't working for you.
You're telling me Majel Barrett can't tell me what they used back then?
Negative.
Yeah. I mean, like, this isn't like some like vague civilization in the Delta Quadrant. It's Earth, San Francisco, where they're from.
I believe it's a plot hole.
Yeah.
Although, speaking of money, I thought it was interesting that Data, the first thing he does in order to get money is trade possibly the most advanced piece of equipment on the planet, which, as far as I can remember, has been used on numerous occasions to create transporters and time machines and hoverboards and fishing rods. And pretty much anything you can think of can be made out of either Geordi's visor or a comms device. And he trades it for a stake in three bits in a poker game.
What did happen to that communicator? Because I'm guessing, you know, in those intervening weeks between parts one and two, and the senior staff managed to get uniforms, start their own Shakespeare troupe, and begin renting an apartment out from Mrs. Carmichael, that, you know, they would have taken their tricorders and searched for the comm badge signal.
Well, he would have gotten it back because he didn't lose the poker hand.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
So he would have gotten it right back right away.
Okay, okay.
Unless he didn't. Unless that guy didn't want to sell it back.
Yeah, he may not have wanted. Maybe he was willing to give up his pimp hat instead of the communicator.
I'm willing to let that one go, I think.
Okay.
One thing that kind
of
bugs me.
Wait a minute. I gave one tiny little bit of argument about like the money. You're like, let's let this one go. It's a con badge. Okay, guys, just forget about it.
I think that's explained, though. I think you can make the assumption that he wanted it back because he wanted, like, obviously everything on the table. That doesn't bother me at all.
Okay.
Well, how come he never saw it again? How come they couldn't... Can't they communicate back and forth?
Yeah. When they land, shouldn't they be immediately going, hello, Crusher to Data?
Hey, Data, you out there? Hello?
Well, there you have it.
Well, okay. Cam still doesn't care, guys.
Getting onto something that did bug me, though, is the alien plot in this, the villains, I think it was too kind of awful. Like, they're murdering a lot of people and disguising it as a cholera outbreak. That's a pretty gruesome act that they're doing.
Yeah, those rainbow lasers were just, like, horrifying. Well,
that's the thing. Like, the way it's portrayed is them walking around, like, shooting beams out of a purse is really goofy.
But it's very Mary Poppins-esque, combined with that snake staff that the guy had.
Yeah. Snake staff. Yeah, like, to me, like...
That's not a euphemism for something, Cam.
Why didn't they just call it a snake? Why did they keep calling it by its taxonomical name?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, everyone from the 24th century.
Yeah.
It's just like, okay.
But, I mean, I thought their plot was a little too gruesome. I think, like, for an episode this playful, there's a way to give it stakes without being like, we're murdering countless people.
Although mostly homeless people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's pretty dark. Yeah, well, that plot didn't necessarily work for me, but the thing that I thought was even more egregious, and as I brought it up before, is the whole, let's just shoot them down with, like, torpedoes.
Yeah, the solution to the problem was... questionable. It felt very rushed, like, oh yeah.
It didn't seem Star Trek-like.
Well, that was probably my, except for Sam Clemens, mm-hmm. probably my main issue, which is an issue with a lot of Star Trek time traveling shenanigans, was the actual time traveling, mm-hmm. which was, whenever they were in the 24th century mm-hmm. and ready to go back, it seemed like there was a big rush, right? They were always... in a hurry to get back there, without really being like, why don't we, you know, rather than have Data's brain be used for one of these things, why not just have Geordi build this thing he did 3 days later in the first place?
Yeah.
Which was, what's the big rush if you're just going back
just
in time?
Travel. Yeah. They have all the time in the world, literally.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I also couldn't really understand, one, how Data became an expert in... you know, basically the fatalistic aspects of time travel, how it did happen, it must happen.
Yeah.
And at the same time, why Guinan is so reluctant to tell anyone anything. I mean, why not just, you know...
Yeah, what would have happened if she did tell Riker not to fire the torpedoes?
Yeah, it's never explained. Like, usually if you're going to present an A and a B, we have to kind of at least have an idea of what's going to happen for A and B. I don't really know what would have happened with the alternate scenario.
She would have said, send Samuel Clemens back in time, don't fire the torpedoes, and you'll get Picard back.
Yeah.
That would have been easy.
Yeah, and I don't really understand what the big deal was with it.
Yeah.
I also found that the whole episode started kind of with Data's mortality.
Yeah.
And then it ended with his head being reattached... and him not being dead. So
yeah, there is no mortality issue at the end. That was never really addressed. He's like, oh, I am immortal.
I just have a 500-year-old head now. did you guys think it was strange, though, like how everyone is so upset that Data's going to die in a 19th century incident? Like, they're just like, oh my God, this ruined their day.
Yeah.
Like, they're like, Data is going to die in the 19th century. It's like, we don't know if that's like, that could be like 800 years from the point with which they're... you know, finding this information out. Like,
or 400 years ago.
But it's like there's no context as to when Data is going to die. It's not like it's saying Data's going to die this week.
But, and it seemed as if they were trying to really push that to be the idea because, like, okay, well, we have to figure out how Data died and we're obviously going to do some time travel in just a few seconds as soon as we go through this cave.
Yeah.
It seemed kind of, I don't know, it was a clear incident of, you know, the writers knowing what was going to happen before the audience did.
Right.
And writing the characters as such.
Yeah. Right. And even Data's reflection on mortality at the outset there, though, you know, where he's talking, oh, now that I've seen my head be removed,
right.
Now finally I know that I can die.
Yeah.
But you're like, well, wait a sec, hadn't you? You know, if someone had asked you, if your head gets taken off, are you going to die?
Yeah.
Yes, I will.
And it's like, okay, so say someone came to me and was like, you know, hey, Cam, just, you know, Tony is going to die in Ogden, Utah. My question would not be like, oh my God, why? It would be like, when? That's the question, like, that would be my only question. It's like,
no, my statement would be, Tony, don't ever go to Ogden, Utah.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Not 3 days later. Well, if the only way of figuring out this time vortex is to send Data down there. Make it so.
Yeah. And there's another issue about sort of the technology of this episode that is a point that I think you want to talk about, which is the techno babble of this episode.
Yeah, there is. But by the way, I'll just point out that I've just noticed that us going through the issues with the time travel stuff is pretty much the same conversation that always happens when you're talking about time travel in Star Trek.
Very true. I think we had the same one in The Voyage Home. Mm-hmm. What did Tony, you had issues, I know, about the techno babble.
Yeah, they laid it on pretty thick, I thought. You know, I don't mind it sometimes as a filler plot device, but where you have, you know, treatises and sub-treatises and about things that don't exist, you know, it could have just been, we need to adjust this thing for it to work, which is pretty much all they were trying to do.
Yeah, instead somebody of, go, aye.
Yeah.
My favorite one was they're talking about the chip or whatever in Data's brain, and he's saying, mine's an R type, Lore's is an L type, and Picard's like, R type, and he's like, yes.
a nice nod to the right brain and the left brain.
Yeah, but it's like Picard.
That's
even
true. That's a good observation.
And interestingly,
John,
I think Data's left-handed as well.
Interesting.
I never knew.
But
did you figure that out watching how he would steer the buggy?
playing poker, you know, just the way he deals.
But Picard seems like outraged, like, R-type, I would never have guessed. And he's like, yes. Cut to like the next line. Like,
I think a lot of it is kind of the vestige of like Piller era writing. Like, he was big.
And Piller did write that first part.
Yeah, but Piller was a big fan of technobabble.
Right.
I love R. Stephen Barrett, absolutely hated it, and there's not much technobabble in like Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the worst, I think, offender in this whole two-parter is a scene early on where Geordi is at the console.
Oh.
No, talking down and going back and forth as you, well, maybe if I adjust the positronic, blah, 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 blah. And it just keeps going back and forth between a couple characters, figure out a solution, but all they're talking is in gibberish.
Yeah, it doesn't have any relation to us or at all.
It's just filler.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although I do wonder, just not really techno-babble, but technology-related, is I kind of, I don't know if it's ever been established in the series, whether Picard learned to input binary code with an iron filing in Data's brain. And if he did, why he didn't just put a full message in there instead of...
I honestly thought he was going to go over to the head and scratch, like, a little note inside of his positronic brain. And, like, you know, Picard was here.
He should have, like, tattooed him, like, in Memento.
Yeah, you gotta wonder, I mean, if Picard was able to do that, that's a good point. I mean, why not just leave... Go get a stone tablet and then also leave that in the cave. And if Picard's able to do that, you know, why can't Guinan just tell them?
Yeah, no kidding.
Why not just get like a pen and just write on Data's body?
Yeah. Well, the body was taken.
Or
back,
I mean, the head,
the
I should say.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think Tony has the best idea. Just Picard should have gone to Guinan and said, hey, when you get back to the 24th century, just let them know. Don't
would
fire
she
the
have
torpedoes.
Though?
You know what? She was concussed, so maybe she didn't really know what was going on. That's why she couldn't answer Riker.
Maybe.
Well, guys, do we have any final thoughts on this episode before we wrap up this evening?
Well, I've got a couple trivia notes I'll get to before we kind of sign off. Number one note, I'll note the severed data head, which looked fantastic, was also used in Phantasms, and it was repurposed as a severed Borg drone head in the Voyager episode Unimatrix Zero.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm. Another note of trivia, Marina Sirtis went on her honeymoon between the filming of these two-parters, so she's much more tan in the second part.
I blame the San Francisco weather.
Mm-hmm. And
Rice-A-Roni.
Rice-A-Roni.
The San Francisco tree.
Oh, of course.
Come on, Cameron.
And
I'm going to ask her that in Vegas.
That would be amazing. Yeah. Alexander Enberg, who played the reporter in part two, is actually the son of Jerry Taylor.
I actually knew that. He also plays a Vulcan in, I believe, Lower Decks.
Yeah, and he was also in Voyager as Vorik.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
But not Tarek, who is the original character from Lower Decks.
Yeah.
Also a Vulcan.
Also.
There you go.
Makes no sense to me, but okay. That's the way it is. Nepotism, man.
And as we established in our lamest lead characters episode, Cam, the Vorik character from Voyager had way more personality than Tuvok ever did.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
How does Sam Clemens match up on your lamest lead characters episode?
You know what? If he was making that journey from recurring guest to main character, I think he could have a good shot at making our list of lamest leads.
Yeah, I think so.
Could you imagine having to sit through him for 7 seasons, just commenting on everything going on?
I look forward to revisiting him in our when we do our best and worst historical figures in Star Trek.
Okay,
I think that could be a really fun episode.
Yeah, he's no Moriarty.
Dave Boris, get started on Time Zero parts 1 and 2.
I'm surprised actually you didn't note it, but before, Cameron, since you're such a big X-Files fan, but the fact that Jerry Hardin was Deep Throat on the X-Files,
of course. Wasn't he also in Time Tracks? Maybe not. I think it was the guy the guy who played Mulder's dad was in Time Tracks.
I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Time Tracks has much less of a following than X-Files. I'm a big fan, but
about Tech Wars?
Tech War? I've never seen Tech War.
No, I'm talking about the novelization, man.
I've also never read a Tech War novel.
I'm talking about the film adaptation of the novelization of the film.
Has anyone at this table read a Tech War novel?
There's actually a whole stack of them in my laundry room 2 apartments ago. And I just
looked
at them. You
gotta stop leaving them down there.
Well, I just looked at them in the free pile and I debated it. And then I was like, no, I'm never going to read these.
How many would you say there were?
I'd say at least 6.
Now, of those 6, how many did Shatner write?
Accumulatively, I'd say he added about 17 of his own pages.
Right.
Yeah. Those are all... Okay, if anyone's out there and they see it says written by William Shatner, he hires ghostwriters to do all these books. Like, let's get real, people.
Why didn't he hire a better ghostwriter?
That's a very good question.
Well, that'd be money.
Or why didn't he spell tech correctly?
That's very 90s way to do it, though.
No, but that's why the ghostwriters were so cheap. They couldn't spell anything.
Before we go, can I just add one more thing? I don't know if guys noticed it. The O'Brien's role in this episode. Where they actually radioed him put him on the communicator, like, O'Brien, did you get him? And then Picard answered for O'Brien, yes, he's fine. I'm here. Good job, O'Brien.
Yeah, they're trying to save a couple bucks. But
would he have been busy with DS9 at that point?
It may have been possible.
I think he would have been.
Yeah, but here's the thing.
How busy?
Well,
you know, there's a lot of important Keiko scenes.
Yes.
Tony just tapped his chest, pretending there was a combat there, audience. I think Colm Meaney, like, as O'Brien, would have been great in 19th century San Francisco.
He would have fit in better than, like, Data.
Yeah. It would have been great if he went around telling people he's a Frenchman.
I'm curious, though, you know, Ron Moore said he would have liked to see this stretch into the season. Do you think this would have been... Like, can you imagine a world now where, like... Because, you know, whatever Star Trek 2017 turns out being, it is going to be more serialized than TNG, for sure. Can you imagine them doing, say four episodes. Could you imagine 4 episodes in this time period?
No. Yeah. I don't know. Like, when he's saying this stretched out over a full season...
He said he just wanted to use it more, like, into the season. I don't think he meant the whole season takes place in the 19th century.
Well, I'm just like, I'm still waiting for the Star Treks to go on, like, if they're just in San Francisco.
Star Trek 1798. It's just basically the adventures of Briscoe County.
Does Samuel Clemens get to wear a Starfleet uniform at some point?
Samuel Clemens, in this version of Trek, he is in the main cast, so I'd say yes.
What about Jack London? Is he the new Wesley Crusher?
They put him on the bridge, too.
Yeah.
But they never leave that planet around the caves. It's just, you know, it's San Francisco and the cave planet the whole time.
Right.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so final thoughts. Let's kind of go around and just kind of give our final thoughts on Time Zero.
Well, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed watching it. I think that Sam Clemens could have been dialed down a bit or dialed up a bit or at least dialed into the episode a bit better. But
say dial once more.
Yeah. You know, I wash with dial every day.
Thank
it
you.
Makes me smell fresh. I don't know. I agree with your guys' points. It was fun. It was nice to see an ensemble. There is issues with time travel and Mark Twain, but that notwithstanding, I thought it was enjoyable.
You know, I have to say that this is my favorite TNG two-parter after Best of Both Worlds. It's fun. It's funny.
You mean so far?
So far, yes.
Yeah, okay, I was going to say, that's a controversial statement if that's the case.
Samuel Clemens, way better than...
All good things.
Yeah. But, you know, this is just a great two-parter, and we've had so many stinkers. Like, I'm sorry, but, like, Redemption Part 2 really kind of, like, wasn't... Here's the thing. There's a lot of great moments in a lot of these two-parters, but, like, the overall thing is that they can't really justify their length as a two-parter. I think this one comes close to justifying its length as a two-parter, even though it was obviously stretched out.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I think this could have been, like, a really crackerjack hour-long episode. You know, you just tighten up everything to do with the villain plot, make it a little more fast-paced, cut out some of the filler. But I think as a two-parter, I kind of appreciate that they gave up trying to, you know, top the Best of Both Worlds.
Right.
They were just like, look, we can't top it, so let's...
So they're going to follow up in Descent Parts 1 and 2.
Yeah. But it's, you know, it's just kind of like, hey, let's just have fun.
Yeah.
Like, let's just do a fun two-parter so the audience can kind of, you know... get engaged with the character comedy and let it be that.
To me, what is so important to this one is it's very clear that they broke the story as they're writing it. Not just part one, but part one and two simultaneously. Like, the story flows, it makes sense, and the characters are consistent.
Mm-hmm. No, for sure. So I think on that note, we'll say our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. Also, leave us a review on our iTunes page. We'd love to read them out. I'll even do it in a Mark Twain voice, if you request. Tony, is that incentive for you to leave a review?
I don't need an incentive to leave a review, Cam.
Okay, well, thank you. You can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Vorik, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's REPORTON, N as in nomination for hair and makeup.
And win, Tyler. And Tony?
You can find me, or at least my name and number, thumbtacked to the church bulletin board. Feel free to give me a call anytime. I'm happy to absolve you of your sins.
And actually, while we're talking about history in this episode, let's give a shout-out to a guest, Dave Boris, who we mentioned just earlier, who has his own podcast now, Cool Canadian History. So every week he's going to be doing 15-minute lessons on Canadian history. Now, Canadian history, just saying the word, bores me. But he actually has stories that make it sound interesting.
Well, hey, you know what? Why don't we just tie it all in together? Make this Star Trek-related Canadian history. One Canadian actor, Bill Shatner, actually played Samuel Clemens on my favorite television show, Murdoch Mysteries.
My favorite too, Tyler. Mm-hmm. So check out the Murdoch Mysteries and also the podcast Cool Canadian History. Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Complete.